Good morning, Dr. Ross. I take it you're well on this Saturday morning.
Absolutely, Brent. Lovely to talk to you, mate.
And to you too. Let's start with a couple of listener questions. Ross says, I have had the unfortunate experience of seeing someone elderly, very sick in hospital just recently. A relative did not like me mentioning to them that I could see both signs of delirium and dementia. Ross, can you please tell me how do you differentiate these two conditions? He says it can be distressing when relatives don't really understand what is happening. Much appreciated from Ross.
Well, I think we should divide this into two things. And to just make it simple for the public, dementia really is a chronic condition that leads to short-term memory loss and loss of executive functions, loss of ability to think properly. Tragically, we've just seen that in the man who has pulled out of the race for the next president of the US. And when you look at Joe Biden, you can see clearly that he has Parkinson's disease, which appears to be getting worse, and possibly the dementia associated with Parkinson's disease, known as Lewy body dementia, which is the more specific Parkinson's disease in that situation. But regardless, there's many different causes of dementia: Alzheimer's disease, vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, frontotemporal dementia, CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, toxin-induced dementia, such as people who drink too much. All of these things can cause dementia, but it's a chronic, slow, deteriorating condition. Whereas delirium is the acute confusional state that can occur on somebody who has background dementia, or can even occur in people who aren't demented but just have such a toxic exposure to something, or such a marked reduction in things like electrolytes, that they can go into a delirious state. So I'll give you one example. There's a condition called the syndrome of inappropriate ADH, and these people have low serum sodiums, and the public thinks, oh, my salt levels in my bloodstream are low, therefore I need more salt. Wrong. If you have normal body volume, so you're not overhydrated or underhydrated, and your sodium levels are low, your sodium is being diluted by excessive water retention caused by this thing called ADH, which stands for antidiuretic hormone, which then retains a whole lot of water. Now, what happens as your sodium drops, you can go into a delirious state where you get very confused and you're all over the shop. That's one example of delirium. You can have acute sepsis and acute infection that can make you delirious, as one example. You can also get, you can be on some medications that can cause delirium. There are other metabolic abnormalities that can cause, as I already mentioned, low sodium, but it can be due to calcium problems. There's a whole lot of different issues that can cause delirium. The big one for elderly people are infections or changes in fluid balance, or even something like an acute stroke can make someone seem like they're delirious, but it's actually the stroke affecting their ability to think properly. So two different categories, delirium being some acute thing, and dementia being a chronic, slow process.
UTIs can cause delirium, can they not, Ross?
Oh, of course. That's what I said. Any septic process, any infection in the body can do it. And it doesn't matter whether it's virus or whether it's bacteria. That can certainly do it. And in fact, in elderly people, often they don't have the symptoms of a urinary tract infection. They're not getting the burning and stinging that younger women might get. All they do is they just seem a bit delirious and maybe have a bit of a fever, or not even a bit of a fever. And that, as I said, can be a manifestation of acute, or can manifest as acute delirium as one cause of all of this stuff.
Now, Dave has one for you. He said, I've read that 300 milligrams is the suggested daily intake of vitamin C. Dave says, how many medium-sized oranges would this be? And are oranges the best way to get vitamin C? And why are raisins always listed as recommended for healthy food options? But he said, I never see sultanas listed. They're both made from dried grapes.
The recommended daily intake of vitamin C is around 100 milligrams, as far as I was aware. So 300 milligrams is three times more than the recommended daily intake. But one orange is around 90 to 100 milligrams, depending on the size of the orange. So really, if you want to get enough vitamin C to prevent scurvy, some sort of citrus fruit per day will certainly help stop that from happening. So in the old days where people didn't understand about vitamin deficiencies, people would go on long sea voyages where obviously they couldn't have fresh fruit, and they get dreadful scurvy where the vitamin C levels were undetectable, and that would damage their blood vessels. They'd get delirious, as we were just talking about there, and they could bleed into their head, bleed into their skin, get a whole lot of bruising. So it is important to get some vitamin C into the system on a daily basis. But our oranges are a very good way of doing it. But I'm a great believer in supplementation. I think vitamin C should be part of a good supplement regimen every day. And I say to people, especially during winter, when you feel a cold coming on, you can take somewhere between 4 to 6 grams a day. So he's talking about 300 milligrams is the recommended daily allowance. I'm talking about 4 to 6 grams a day. So that's 4,000 to 6,000 milligrams per day of vitamin C. A study out of Finland shows that can dong a cold on the head. So it doesn't stop you having a cold, but it minimises the severity and the length of the cold by doing that. So I think it's a good thing for people to have oranges anyhow, because not only are you getting the vitamin C, but you're also getting what's called the polyphenol. So you and I have spoken for many years about the bergamot products that I have an association with, and I can't mention the actual product on air, but the ingredient is bergamot from bergamot oranges grown in the Southern Ionic Strip of Calabria. But what's very beneficial in those things, which are also in oranges but just not in the same extent, are these polyphenols or plant chemicals that have a profound effect on metabolism. And plus, when you're having the orange itself, you're getting the fiber from the substance of the pulp of the orange, and that fiber is very good for the body as well. So I would endorse anyone having at least one orange a day to get about 100 milligrams of vitamin C. But if you want to top up your levels, it's important to supplement in that situation. Now, as far as the raisins versus sultanas, I'm not sure why we focus on one and not the other, but they're both very good for you.
Speaking of supplements, in our topics today, it is our first topic is multivitamins. And there's a survey to say they're bad. There's a survey to say they're good. There's a survey to say they're a waste of money. Are they good? Are they bad? Are they a waste of money? It depends, doesn't it, Ross, on which side of the fence you sit?
It does depend on which side of the fence and which study you read. And the interesting thing was, you would have read the article that I sent you on this, that there was a big study of just over 390,000 US adults followed up for 20 years who were generally healthy at the start of the study, and showed that those who took a multivitamin versus those who didn't for most of that 20 years were no healthier, didn't die any less than the people who didn't take the multivitamins. And they said, so therefore, vitamins are useless. And the ridiculous thing in this particular study is the author of the study said that one of the reasons why, in their view, is that people who take multivitamins also tend to be more health conscious, and therefore more health conscious people tend to look after themselves better. So the multivitamin is just a marker for people who are more health conscious. But then they said that people who are sicker often take multivitamins in an attempt to mitigate their illness. It just didn't make sense to me, that the whole sort of tenet of the study. But then there was another study from a few months ago called the COSMOS study that put together three different aspects of this trial. 5,000 people over 2 years, those who took a multivitamin every day, had much better cognition and memory than those who didn't take the multivitamin. So we're not just talking about whether it prevents death. We're talking about what it does for many different types of diseases. So to give you another example, there's a little-known university in America called Harvard. And Harvard have been doing, for the last 30 years, the Nurses' Health Trial, the Male Physician Study. And they've looked at all different parameters of health, whether it's exercise, smoking, diet, whether you take vitamins, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the sub-studies looked at the benefits of multivitamins. Now, up to 10 years, no benefit at all. But when you got to 10 years in the males, there was an 8% reduction in cancer and cataracts, which is not much, but 8% is pretty good for a multivitamin, harmless multivitamin. When you got to 15 years in the nurses, 75% reduction in bowel cancer, 25% reduction in breast cancer, 23% reduction in cardiovascular disease. When you got to the doctors at 20 years, and what anally retentive neurotic would take a multivitamin every day for 20 years? You're actually talking to one. And that reduces your risk for cardiovascular disease by about 44%. It's better than a statin, but it takes a long time to get there. It's a bit like the hare and the tortoise. So the pharmaceutical drugs are like the hare, get you there quicker, but you can fall over and knock your head and kill yourself. Whereas the supplements are much longer, but it takes you longer to get there, but with much less harm. Now, interestingly, this is a very complex subject, but here's the basic bottom line of this whole thing. 50% of the population, 50% of people listening to this radio segment have been born with a gene mutation called the MTHFR gene. That stands for methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. And this gene is a really important gene in regulating what we call one carbon metabolism. I don't want to get too heavy into this, but that's basically a major regulation in the generation of DNA, RNA, and proteins. So if you're born with that mutation and you take a particular type of standard folic acid, you may be developing in your bloodstream a thing called unmetabolized folic acid, which as you get older can cause more damage than it does good. So the simple solution here is to either have the MTHFR gene checked, and it's just a blood test to see if you've got it, or there's a fourth generation folic acid, and again, I can't name the product on air, but a fourth generation folic acid called 5' methyl tetrahydrofolate that bypasses that mutation and has the benefits. And the studies are now showing that people who go straight for that supplement rather than taking something with standard folic acid don't get any issues, but they get the benefits from it. So I just think basically either we all take this standard fourth generation folic acid, or you go off and have the blood test to see where you are. And they're the people who are going to benefit from taking a higher quality multivitamin, which has got this newer version of folic acid, as opposed to the old standard stuff, which I think now that we've got the better stuff, we should be using it.
If you have a balanced diet, your 5 servings of fruit and vegetables every day, and I know only a very low percentage of Australians do that, but if you do that, do you still need to take a multivitamin supplement?
Oh, absolutely. You see, because if we lived how we were designed to live, and we were designed to live for 30, 40 years wandering around a jungle with a spear, that's it. We weren't designed to go double our use-by date in a very synthetic world where basically our physiology was designed to be a little bit malnourished because the food wasn't always available. You ate when the food was available, but you might go a day or two where you didn't eat a lot of food. Now, under those circumstances, you don't need a multivitamin because you only live 30, 40 years and you're eating natural foods off the tree, the nuts and the berries that have got a whole lot of these folic acid and B12, B6, and all the other B group vitamins and vitamin C, et cetera. But in our society, we have this processed packaged crap masquerading as food. We sit in our bums all day. We're overfed. We've got fat bellies and all of these sort of things. And this is tragic, Brent, but less than 10% of people have 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day. And as I said, 50% of people have this MTHFR gene abnormality. So I want them to have as better quality B group vitamins as they possibly can have. And I think from all the studies, my reading of the studies and the research I've done over many years shows that supplementation of higher quality supplements does give you an extra benefit over and above lifestyle. So I don't think just being on a healthy lifestyle is good enough if you really want optimum health. I think 80% of all of our management is having no addictions, good quality sleep, good quality eating and less of it, 3 to 5 hours every week of moderate exertion, and most importantly, happiness. That's 80%. And then you get the other benefits from either pharmaceutical drugs if you need it and supplements.
Okay. Python teeth. Now, here's a very interesting story. What most people, when they think about pythons, they visualize these huge snakes devouring their prey. But python teeth may actually reduce the risk of rotator cuff re-tearing.
Basically, a surgeon had this thought. When he looked at python teeth, they're sharp, backward curving teeth, and they're perfect for grasping soft tissue rather than cutting through it. And so what pythons do when they catch their prey is with their teeth, they can just hold on to the rabbit or whatever they're eating at the time, and the rabbit can't get out of their grasp, but they don't break the skin. They just hold the thing in their weird teeth. So this surgeon looked at the teeth and looked at the way pythons caught any sort of animal, and so devised these little forceps based on these teeth. And he found that when he was doing a rotator cuff repair, which is a shoulder problem, is incredibly common in people as we get older, especially. And over the age of 65, over 40% of these tears break down. And if you get even older, over 90% of people who have massive tears will have a failure of these repairs. But he found that with these new forceps that he designed around the python teeth, he was able to grab so much more of the tendon tissue and get a much better repair with the teeth. So, and he used 3D printing to do all this stuff as well. So it could be that sometime in the very near future, this becomes standard of care for people who have rotator cuff injuries. And it's interesting, mate, that over the age of 65, well over 50% of people have a tear in their rotator cuff, which causes marked pain and immobility in the shoulder.
Exercise, you always say 3 to 5 hours of exercise each and every week. If you can do the 5 hours, that's all good. But heavy resistance training may have long-term benefits for older adults.
Yeah, this is a study of just over 450 adults over the age of 65, split into three groups. Group number one, high resistance training, where they actually went to a gym and used machines to strengthen their legs and their arms 3 times a week. Group number two, moderate resistance training, where they went to a hospital once a week and had some supervised exercise using things like squats and leg presses, etc., but not using heavy machines, and then suggested a couple of times a week to continue the exercise at home. And then they looked at the third group, which was just the non-exercise group, where they were allowed to do what they liked, but they weren't encouraged to do any of these resistance training exercises. They did this for 12 months, and they followed them up for a further 3 years. So it could have been that many of these people continued on their behaviours anyhow, but they found that those who were in the high resistance training group had much less visceral fat mass, much greater isometric leg strength in their quadriceps, and when they did brain and thigh MRIs on some of these people, there was much less deterioration in their brain, and their thighs had much thicker muscles by doing it. So it's just basically reinforcing what we say all the time, that when you do exercise, in my view, it should be 2/3 cardio and 1/3 resistance training.
Ross, was there any difference between group one and group two, i.e. the group that went to the gym and the second group that basically did it themselves at home, leg squats, maybe push-ups, those sort of things?
Oh, yeah, there was a difference. And there was better, the more you did, the better, and the more intensive it was, the better benefit you got.
So the takeaway from that is, you know, it's okay to do a walk every day, but you've got to try and do some low-intensity exercise included in your exercise regime weekly.
Yeah, no doubt. And look, everyone's heard of osteoporosis, which is weakening of your bones as you get older. But a lot of people haven't heard the term sarcopenia, which is weak muscles. And exactly the same thing happens. From the age of 30, your osteoporosis starts. From 50, when the hormones go south, it accelerates. Exactly the same thing with sarcopenia. And you need strong muscles to support strong bones, because if you've got weak muscles, you have weak bones. It all goes together. And what's one of the best things you can do for osteoporosis is have regular resistance training.
People are always sucking on water out of a bottle, but there is new research out that says BPAs, which obviously are in the plastic bottles, are linked to type 2 diabetes, or the risk of type 2 diabetes.
There's long been an association between people who have exposure to BPA-like substances. So BPA, bisphenol A, which is one of the major components of plastics used for water bottles and some cans and baby bottles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so when you and I were kids or having our children, we didn't even know about this stuff. So kids were fed out of hard plastic bottles, and we used to reheat the bottles, and all the plastic would leach into the milk and cause all sorts of issues. We didn't even think about it. But then the research started to come through. But there's still not been a study until now to show that there was a direct causal link between the BPA and insulin resistance, which is the thing that sets you up for diabetes, high blood pressure, cholesterol issues, fat around the belly, and all the problems that come from that. So what they did was they took a group of 40 healthy, non-active adults, 22 females and 18 males, and they firstly put them on a low BPA diet. That just means a diet where things weren't wrapped in plastic or didn't come in plastic. They measured their urine and blood samples to see how much BPA they had to ensure they had low BPA during that, those couple of days. And then they did this thing called this insulin clamp technique, which is a way of directly measuring someone's insulin resistance. Now, if anyone's listening and say, oh, I'd like to find out whether I'm insulin resistant, you don't need to go through this thing. This is a research technique. You know if you're insulin resistant because you're pre-diabetic, diabetic, your blood pressure's up, your triglycerides are up, your HDL's down, and you've got fat around your belly. You're insulin resistant. Don't go off and ask for this test. But they did it in this trial just to prove that whether the BPA did or didn't make someone more insulin resistant. So then they put these people onto a four-day trial of high levels of BPA, but these levels were still at the American Environmental Protection Agency, what they call their safe dose, 50 micrograms per kilogram. What is the safe dose of a poison? I don't know. And they found that those people had a marked increase in insulin resistance after 4 days just by being exposed to this stuff. So the bottom line with all of this is try to avoid as much as stuff that's in plastic that you can. Open your fridge, tell me what's not in plastic. But when you're drinking out of anything, make sure it's stainless steel or a thing. A lot of people haven't heard of this before. It's called glass. So drink out of that and BPA-free cans, although I still have a problem with anything that's in a can.
We have talked about eating ultra-processed foods before. You don't have to be Einstein, Ross, to realise that if you eat too much of this gunk, it's not good for you. But surveys and research tell us that a diet heavy in ultra-processed foods may increase the risk of mortality by as much as 10%.
Yep. Yeah, and this is just something that really it reinforces what we already know. So people who have a lot of things like hot dogs, sausages, deli meats, anything out of a container that can sit in a container with in a thickened, hardened state with a use-by date, these are all the ultra-processed foods. So this was nearly a 23-year study of 500,000 people showing clearly that the more ultra-processed foods you have, the more your death risk. And the death risk is 10%, but still 10% is still a lot of people. And purely something you can do something about, eat more natural food. So really the bottom line here is eat less food, eat more natural food.
Eat less food, eat more natural food. I think that's one of the big problems that we have as being a society of overweight people. We put too much food on the plate and somehow, even though we don't need it, we finish the food that's on the plate, probably because, you know, the wife or husband's cooked it, they put it on the plate, so you eat it because you don't feel like sending it back.
Yep, absolutely. So I just think we've got to eat off smaller plates, don't have second helpings, and just eat less food. It's obvious stuff, and doctors and people like me, so doctors, nutritionists, whatever, we say this all the time and it just seems to fall on deaf ears.
All right, Ross, our time is up. I better let you go. And I've got a couple of questions left over, but we'll save them. Maybe we'll do them next week.
Absolutely. Talk to you then, mate.
As always, mate, thanks a lot. Look after yourself and we'll talk to you next weekend. Thanks, Ross.